Welcome to our new podcast, Stand Up for Reefs. My name is Kate Holden, and I will be presenting this podcast with help from special guests throughout the series. I work for CCMI, or the Central Caribbean Marine Institute, and we specialise in protecting coral reefs via research, education and conservation. Later on in this episode, I will be joined by Dr. Gretchen Goodbody-Gringley, who is CCMI's Director of Research. But before Gretchen joins us, let's set the scene. There are many of us around the world that are working hard to try and find solutions to balance human versus environmental needs. The team at CCMI works specifically on coral reef protection, looking into how coral reef ecosystems can survive, adapt, and hopefully thrive for the future. The reason we've put this podcast series together is we felt there is a lot of interest in coral reefs and especially the ocean, but helping people to tap into useful and engaging information and discussion on coral reefs is not that easy. First of all, before we go any further, it is our belief that everybody, wherever you are, whoever you are, can make a difference to reefs. So the Stand Up for Reefs campaign, which will be launched on World Ocean Day, includes a range of resources that we'll share with you online. Yes, there are some big issues facing coral reefs, but we have many superpowers as individuals and as part of society. If we really want change, we can make it happen. Why do we need to stand up for coral reefs? This is going to be the short version, the back of the cereal packet explanation. But beaches, coastlines, and our beautiful seas are all interconnected via one global ocean. The ocean that I visit in the south coast of the UK is directly connected to the ocean that washes up on the shores of the United States of America thousands and thousands of miles away. The ocean covers over 70% of the Earth. It is absolutely massive. Unfortunately, though, very little of the ocean is protected, and that is important for us to all know and understand. Much of the ocean is beyond national jurisdiction, and which is problematic from a governance perspective. So whilst the ocean is connected, the approach to taking care of the ocean and protecting the ocean is not. Coral reefs support 25% of all marine life and provide homes and protections for up to 1 million species. So they contribute to global biodiversity. So coral reefs can be found in the tropics, as well as colder and deeper locations around the globe, but you are closer to and perhaps more reliant upon a reef than you think. Coral reefs are also animals, so not only are they important ecosystems, but we rely on them for tourism, our own pleasure, and like all animals, they are vulnerable. So what's going on? Why does the ocean, and particularly coral reefs, why do they need protection? Is warming due to climate change, and species are being pushed to their thermal limits. Example, if you suddenly had to go and live in a freezer and didn't have protective clothing, you would find it very, very difficult to survive. Likewise, if you're suddenly in an incredibly hot environment and you don't have the tools to adapt, you would find it very hard to survive. And that is what's happening to our corals. They are hot and they are being pushed to their thermal limits. Corals specifically are bleaching, and more frequent storms and powerful storms are eroding coastlines and habitats. Climate change is creating, you know, superstorms and bizarre weather. It's May here and it hailed yesterday in the UK. Just unbelievable. So you add that all together and it is like a hotbed of mess for coral reefs. The ocean, unfortunately, is the world's biggest carbon sink and it absorbs all the carbon dioxide from the air, making its chemical makeup change. So it becomes more acidic and it weakens calcium carbonate structures. Now, what that means is, you know, corals have skeletons just like we do. And the increased acid in the water is weakening those skeletons. There are a couple of statements here before we move on that are quite important if you're thinking, well, what is bleaching and why is the ocean becoming a carbon sink? We will address them with Gretchen. So hold those thoughts, especially the makeup of corals and what bleaching is and does. But before we move on, in addition to warming oceans, many marine species are being fished quicker than they can naturally be replenished. And marine animals are choking on the myriad of plastic that is swishing around our beautiful oceans. So the magic information here is climate change is threatening reefs, but so are plastic pollution, degradation of habitats, invasive species, and overfishing. Impacting climate change as individuals is difficult, but it can be done. But some of those other issues, plastic, pollution, degradation of habitat, we can definitely, definitely help with that. So before you turn off your phones or computers, it is not all bad. This is not a show of doom. There are many successful conservation practices and research methods that are protecting species. And more importantly, everyone can help. And this is not just a problem for the scientists to solve or governments to solve. We can all get involved and stand up for reefs. Hello, Gretchen, and welcome to Stand Up for Reefs.
Hello, thanks for having me.
So before we get into the importance of coral reefs, let's find out a little bit about you. You are the Director of Research at CCMI, and you have a marine field station based in Little Cayman, which for people who don't know is a tiny tropical island 80 miles away from Grand Cayman. So Gretchen, you are a special type of scientist. Can you tell us what you do?
Yeah, I am an evolutionary ecologist, which means I study how the ecosystem functions and mechanisms that have enabled organisms to survive.
Wow, that sounds pretty technical. So what do you love about the ocean and coral reefs?
I think what I love the most about the ocean and coral reefs is just the diversity of organisms and life that exists there. So, you know, all the bright different colored fishes and the different shapes and sizes of the different species of corals, but also the little tiny creatures that live within the corals. There's just so much to see everywhere you turn, and I think that's what makes it such an exciting ecosystem.
Did you always want to be a scientist?
You know, I did. I have wanted to be a scientist since I was a little girl. I think I started out my scientific career at like the age of 7 by collecting worms and salamanders in the woods behind my house and creating terrariums in my garage and sort of watching how all these little animals would interact in this little habitat that I would create for them. And I think I decided I was going to be a marine biologist when I was about 12, and I did a camp, sort of like the camps that we run at CCMI, but the camp that I did was in Honduras.
Oh, cool. That's pretty cool. And how old were you when you learned to dive?
I was 16 when I learned to dive in the Florida Keys.
And what made you, had you always wanted to do it? What made you decide to take the plunge?
Well, I was very vocal about wanting to become a marine biologist, and my best friend at the time, her family was taking a vacation to the Florida Keys, and in advance of that trip, they were all going to get certified, and so she invited me to come on the trip, and along with that, to get certified to dive with her family, and so that was sort of a huge gift that she gave me, was that opportunity to become a scuba diver.
Oh, that is awesome. And so what is special about the type of research that you do?
Well, a lot of the work that I do is extremely technical, but I think probably what sets me apart from all the other marine ecologists out there is where I study. And that is because I study the deepest parts of the coral reef. So my focus is on corals that lie between 30 meters and 60 meters. Or for those of us in the United States, that would be about 100 feet to 200 feet deep.
And for those of us that are not divers, the recreational dive limit is 130 feet. Is that right?
And that's correct.
Yep. So you are a tech diver.
That's right. So it's taken me about 6 years of additional training to become a technical diver, to be able to reach these depths and also be able to do science at these depths, because there's a huge difference between being able to dive down to that deep and just look around and being able to dive down that deep and conduct an experiment.
So when you're down there, what kind of stuff are you doing?
A lot of times I'm measuring organisms, so counting fish, estimating the size of fish, counting corals and identifying to species, measuring corals, taking small samples of organisms that I bring back into the lab and then analyze for things like their structure, so their physical structure, or their DNA. So I'll sequence the DNA and look for changes in the genes expression or genome across the depth gradient. So a variety of different tools that I'm using.
So that's pretty interesting. Now, you are obviously, so what makes you quite unique is the depths that you dive to. So my next question, which I think links quite nicely, is we talked in the intro a little bit about threats facing reef and the impacts of climate change. So could you explain to our listeners a few of the terms for us just before we talk about your specific research? So what is coral bleaching?
So coral bleaching is a response by the corals to an increase in seawater temperature. And the reason this happens is because corals live in a very intimate relationship with algae that reside inside their tissue. And the algae are photosynthesizing and giving energy from the sun to the coral. So the coral actually gets about 90% of its energy from these algae transferring photosynthate to them. When it gets too warm, this relationship becomes stressed. And oftentimes what will happen is the coral will kick out the algae because it starts producing toxic oxygen radicals. So this means that basically the algae are now making the coral sick when it's too hot. And so the coral gets rid of the algae. The problem with that is that then it doesn't have enough energy. So it's not able to meet all of its needs. It can't consume enough zooplankton to subsidize, and oftentimes it will result in the coral dying. So the reason we call it coral bleaching is because the loss of that algae means the loss of the color. So most of the color that we see on the coral reef is because of the algae that lives within the coral. If you lose the algae, then the coral becomes white because all you're seeing is the white skeleton through a translucent layer of tissue.
Ah, that's super interesting. So is this a new phenomenon, bleaching?
It's not new per se, but it has become more frequent. So we noticed the first global bleaching event happen in 1989, and then we've seen recurrent bleaching events since then that have been increasing in intensity and also frequency.
Okay, that's cool. So why is it such a big deal for reefs in particular? Not only the bleaching, but just the warming of the oceans?
Because corals live at really the upper level of the temperature that they can tolerate, just a very slight increase in temperature will cause the reef to bleach and potentially die. And so these corals are decades old, and you don't get that reef within a single year. So rebuilding a reef that has died from a massive bleaching event will take decades. And so, the ramifications of that loss will be long-term.
Can they recover from a bleaching event?
They can recover from bleaching, so they can obtain new algae from the seawater. It just depends on how long that thermal stress is happening. So if it stays really warm for a long time, then usually they can't recover. If a storm comes through or something and the water temperature drops, then oftentimes they will recover. And that's actually a mechanism for adaptation, we think, as well. When they do recover from a bleaching event, there's some evidence that they retain sort of a memory of that event, or they obtain new algae that are higher tolerant or more tolerant to high temperatures. So there is the potential that short-term stress events could, in fact, promote adaptation to climate change.
Just like when we get a virus or a flu or something, and then we recover from it and we're stronger.
Yeah, or a vaccine.
or a vaccine. Excellent. And so you were looking at corals at depth. So what is it about climate and coral resiliency that's taking your work to tech levels?
Yeah. So interestingly, you know, because corals live at this high end of their temperature tolerance, we've started looking for areas where they don't live at the high end of their temperature tolerance. And one of those places is down deep. So we think that corals that are living deeper are buffered from the impacts of climate change and also things like pollution and human impacts because they're just farther away from shore. So this has led to people proposing the potential that deep reefs could be a refuge for survival in the future for coral reefs. And so that's why I'm focusing on that range, is to look to see if, in fact, corals that are living at depth have a different tolerance to temperatures, have different responses to temperature and to different stressors.
Have they moved before, corals? So over time, have they moved up and down the reef, or do they tend, you know, is there any historical evidence for this?
Sure. So, you know, sea level has risen and fallen over the millennia. And with that, corals have, you know, inhabited shallower waters as sea level rises and then retreated back as sea level falls. And so there is the capacity for them to do this. You know, they have a stage in their life when they're motile, which is when they're larvae. So during when they're babies, basically, you know, they're swimming around these tiny little things in the water column, and then they can settle really anywhere on the reef. And that's actually one of the main focal points of my research, is where these larvae settle and can they settle deep, or does it matter where the parents came from as to where their babies establish themselves?
And that's super interesting. So how far, you might not know this, I don't know, how far do larvae travel? Like, do we know?
Yeah, so they can travel quite a long distance because for some species, the larvae are in the water column for over 2 weeks. And
oh,
so
wow.
They get carried away by ocean currents, which is why we find such a high degree of connectivity amongst all the coral reefs in the Caribbean. So basically, every island is essentially connected to one another. All of our ecosystems are connected because the larvae are passing back and forth every year.
Oh, wow. I didn't realize it was such a huge breadth of connectivity. So that's pretty interesting. So in terms of the coral reef ecosystem, obviously we focused a little bit on the corals themselves, but the ecosystem obviously has a bigger picture impact, particularly on, you know, all of us anywhere, wherever we are reliant on reefs, but we might not recognize that. So for anybody that's listening, you know, why is the coral reef ecosystem important to them, to us, to everyone?
Well, there are several reasons. And I think one of the most, you know, less tangible reasons would be the carbon uptake of reefs. I said that they have algae within their corals. So anything that's photosynthesizing is actually uptaking carbon dioxide and releasing oxygen. So that in itself is great because they are a buffer to climate change. But more tangible aspects of the reef that are important to everyday human existence is, for one, anyone living on or near the seashore. The coral reef provides a buffer to wave action. And as hurricanes are becoming more frequent and larger and more intense, the capacity of that reef to absorb that energy is really critical to our survival when we're faced with these massive storms and wave surge. So just having the reef there intact will help protect all of our local population. And another very tangible service that we get from the reef is, of course, food. You know, without a coral reef, the fish aren't there. And so there's been a lot of work done looking at how fish respond to the loss of coral reefs through things like bleaching events. And we do see that a very clear and fast response by the fish populations, that they will move on to other places as soon as that reef structure is gone. And so if we lose our coral reefs, we will lose that food source.
Wow, that's huge. And so there's obviously, we focus a little bit on climate change, but there's other things going on in the ocean that are not helping ocean or coral reef health. I was reading a report the other day about drinks containers, and it's by ReLoop and Changing Markets Foundation. And they've said that the number of drinks sold in 1999, either in plastic cups, glasses, glass cans or cartons, was 685 billion. And that has gone up to today, 1.3 trillion ready-to-use drinks. So I was quite surprised about that because I thought that maybe as a world we were moving away from convenience, but it would appear not. But of that huge 1.3 trillion, PET, which is single-use plastic, has gone from 17% to 42%. So, you know, when people are buying drinks that are in plastic, throwaway single-use containers, we've seen the turtles, we've seen the jellyfish, but what does it do to the reefs? What particularly can plastic do to our reef systems?
Well, plastic doesn't degrade, so it's there forever. And I think the biggest impact that we see is that it just is littered all over the bottom of the ocean. And in doing that, it's suffocating these animals. You can imagine if somebody threw a large tarp over you and you couldn't get that tarp off. I mean, that's what it feels like to these animals. So, it's really a physical threat to the reef because of just the actual presence. But then there's also chemical leaching. So a lot of these plastics, as they're in the water more, will leach out components of that plastic into the surrounding seawater that can become toxic to the organisms.
And that's obviously also often seawater we're swimming in, or, not just the coral reef systems. Ugh, yuck. So I want to ask you very quickly about a topic that has come up, but I'm going to ask you through a very specific lens. So Seaspiracy, which is obviously hit the headlines about fish. And I'm going to ask you from a very specific viewpoint, which relates to our discussion today, not a should we all become vegan standpoint, but... How does overfishing impact coral reef systems, and why should people, particularly who don't live near a coral reef, care?
I think second to climate change, overfishing is the biggest threat to coral reefs and to the marine environment in general. We have been over-harvesting the ocean for centuries, and we've seen the ramifications of that with the extirpation of several species. For example, the Atlantic cod is probably the best known case. Obviously whaling took a major toll on the population of whales. And these were fishing efforts. And so we have to keep those in mind, and that every time we are extracting live animals from their habitat, we are having an impact on that habitat. I think coral reef ecologists have spent decades investigating the various impacts of overfishing versus pollution versus climate change, which are really the big three impacts that we have on the reef. And overfishing continuously comes up as this threat that has an immediate response that we can quantify, because we see an impact all the way down the food chain. If all you're removing even are the largest fish from the habitat, say grouper, for example, that has impacts on the fish that they consume, and then the fish that those fish consume, all the way down to the herbivores and the parrotfish that are responsible for keeping the reef clean of algae. So I mean, I'm a strong proponent of reducing our take of marine life. I don't think that we can ask the world to stop eating fish altogether, but I think that there are mechanisms that we can implore to reduce our impact onto those populations.
So I think that's super interesting. And I had somebody ask me the other day, what do you do, Kate? And I was like, I definitely limit my protein. I'm conscious of it. And that's all protein, not just fish. And I try and buy local where I can. And I think that if anybody's listening and thinking, how can I help? What can I do? I think sustainable product resourcing, regardless of what it is a huge way that people can make a difference and put pressure on supermarkets or suppliers of, whatever protein, to do it in a responsible manner. And I think what was interesting about Seaspiracy was it's not just about being responsible to the fish, it's about being responsible to the local culture, about being responsible to, you know, husbandry. So not just necessarily transferring into farming of animals that's done potentially not in the best way. At CCMI, we do lots of large events. And I think this is the kind of thing that people potentially don't think about but could make a difference in. Is like, we make sure that if we're doing a big event for people, so it's mass catering, that everything is as sustainably resourced as possible. There's a lot of things that businesses could do, but just having a balance, I think, would help. Now, we have a little predator, Mr. Lionfish, who is a very good example, I think, of we should be eating more lionfish in the Atlantic and the Caribbean. Because can you tell us a little bit about Mr. Lionfish and what he does?
Yeah, so the lionfish is native to the Indo-Pacific region. There are two species that have been introduced into the Caribbean and Western Atlantic, Turoas miles and Turoas volitans. And collectively, we call them lionfish. Lionfish are considered a negative into the invaded habitat because they eat quite a lot for their body size. But they also reproduce quite frequently. A single female can produce 30,000 eggs every 4 days. So a single female could potentially be producing over 2 million eggs per year. So that's a lot. Obviously, all of those eggs don't survive onto the reef. But this has enabled the lionfish to really take hold across the region and establish itself in as a meso predator and probably one of the most influential predators in coral reef ecosystems in the Caribbean today. There's been a lot of effort on how we can manage these populations, and it does look as though targeted control or removal efforts do have an impact and can manage the lionfish population. The interesting thing is that those removals need to happen relatively frequently and continuously over time. So one thing we've noticed, for example, with COVID, is that the lionfish population, at least here in Cayman, has started to rebound again. So there have been a continuous decline in lionfish over the last, 5-6 years. And now people aren't in the water as frequently culling. We're not having our major or our big culling events. And I'm seeing more and more lionfish on the reef every time I go out. So it is something that we need to continue to do, which is what makes it such a great option as a protein source. Because, if we need to go out there continuously and be removing lionfish all the time, then we should be putting those lionfish on people's plates, putting them in the market, putting them in the restaurants, and making sure that this is a viable way for people to get their protein and make it accessible to the general population.
That's fantastic, actually. And there was a, they've just done, the UN has released a list of species that are recovering. And the Cayman Islands Nassau Grouper Program, which has involved protection of the sites where they spawn, has had a huge impact in the populations have been able to recover. So I think what's really interesting about Gretchen's point is, if you're visiting the Cayman Islands or anywhere in the Caribbean, look for lionfish on the menu and stop looking for things like grouper, which are sensitive species. So, when people are like, oh, I don't know what to help, I don't know how to engage with this, we've just come up with a few examples here. So if you are going to eat fish, do it as sustainably as possible, understand where it's coming from. And if there are local sensitivities, you have a responsibility to find out what those are, especially if you're visiting different places. Gretchen also just mentioned the, you can hunt lionfish in the Cayman Islands, and for divers and the competent people in the water, that is an option. It's quite fun. It's not, spearfishing is not something you can do in Cayman, so it gives people the option. Is there anything else, Gretchen, that you think people could do at home to help reefs? Something, not everybody is in the Caribbean. What could we do?
Well, I think one of the things you touched on, which I think is probably the most important thing that we can do, is eat local. I think that, choosing sustainable fish options or sustainable food options is somewhat of a first world problem. So for people who are might not have the resources to buy the more expensive types or organically grown beef, whatever, Going for that local option is really the most environmentally sustainable thing that you can do. Not just because it's probably, not had a lot of impact in terms of removal of that organism, but just because it didn't have to get on a plane or a cargo ship or a big truck and travel across the world to get to you and be held in a freezer that's using electricity. There are just all these steps associated with getting food from far away. So if you eat locally, it's probably going to be healthier for you and healthier for the planet in general.
Excellent. Thank you.
Use reusable straws and cups. I have, a metal cup that I use and I take it everywhere with me. It keeps my drinks cold all day long. It's so much better than buying plastic bottles. So definitely reuse containers rather than buying those single-use plastics.
Yeah, 1.3 trillion drinks that we're buying as a globe. That's a frightening amount. That's a good tip. Thank you. So before we go, we are going to end with a true or false quiz for you.
Okay.
You are going to know most of these answers, but some of our listeners might not. So number one, corals are the largest structures of biological origin. True or false?
Probably true.
It certainly is true. They are. Okay, corals have been dated back over 240 million years.
I would say that's true.
That is definitely true. Corals are found in cooler waters.
Yes.
That is true.
True.
40% of marine life is thought to be dependent on reefs.
I would think it's higher than that.
Well, the official stat is actually 25%, but I think it's a valid answer because I think that is worked out on literally living on the reef, not all the pelagic species and all the connectivity that rely on reefs. So that's kind of a trick question. Sorry, that's rude. The Great Barrier Reef began growing 5,000 years ago.
No, longer than that.
It's false. It's 20,000 years is where they've dated the current, iteration. But it's probably been building for millions of years. Deep sea corals.
With stromatolites.
Oh, there we go. Oh, yeah, don't add loss with your words. Deep sea corals can thrive up to depths of 20,000 feet.
Probably.
Mm-hmm. It's true. It is true.
Leptosirus, I would say.
Yeah, I don't know who's been to see them to verify that fact, but...
They go down in submarines or ROVs, send ROVs down.
Yeah, that's very frightening. Plastic is beginning to impact corals. True or false?
True.
Coral bleaching kills corals.
Not necessarily.
That's the right answer. It's false. They can recover. Corals can adapt to warming oceans.
True.
And my final, everyone can help protect coral reefs and the ocean.
Of course. Everyone can do their part.
There we go. Thank you very much. That is our podcast for today with Dr. Gretchen.
Thanks for having me.